If you took a glance at the bulletin, you see that the title for the sermon is A Framework for Missions Engagement. A Framework for Missions Engagement. So thinking of that framework, I'd like to share a little story from my youth. I grew up, my father was a pastor, and his first pastorate, one out in New York before I was born, and then in Connecticut for a little while. When I was young, we were up to in northern New Hampshire, north of the mountains, in a little place called Sugar Hill. Then after that, the next place that he was a pastor was in Grasmere. It's a hamlet of Goffstown. It was a hamlet, a little hamlet of about 15 homes, not too far from maybe 15 miles from Manchester, New Hampshire. And you can picture the scene there, the old typical New England church, white, big, huge steeple, a little gravel parking lot. And then across the parking lot was the parsonage, an old New England farmhouse. And that's where I spent 6 years of my life. And loved to play baseball, but during the wintertime, it was hard to do. So we usually would have snowball fights. We'd build these huge forts in the parking lot where they plow up the snow. We'd build these huge forts. And then the four of us children that lived in that hamlet, there was only four of us, a brother, a year older, another brother, a year younger, myself, and a neighbor who was 4 years older. So we were the crew. And we tired one day of having a snowball fight, and we were walking back around the front of the parsonage, and you can picture the parsonage, just a big white New England home with an L out the back, and then an L off the L, and then the shed off the L that goes out to the barn, and the barn offset on one side. So as we were walking around the corner of the parsonage, there were their snowballs. It was one of those perfect days for snowballs. There was the barn, big green sliding door, and then one window up above the door, high up on the barn, put in the time of George Washington for sure. In the window, five panes were broken out, been broken for decades. Seven panes, one of those typical New England 12 painters. Seven panes were still there. But somebody came up with this brilliant idea that, hey, let's see if we can take out the rest of the panes. Well, my older brother, he was strong enough to reach the barn door. That was it. My younger brother couldn't reach the barn. We were 40, 45 yards away. The older kid, he could reach it, but his aim wasn't any good. So he managed to take out one pane. And I, the baseball pitcher with an arm like a cannon, was, to be quite frank, I was mocking them. I said, you guys are lame. I said, watch this. And then in short order, it went ping, 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 ping. Took out the rest of the six panes. And then I thought, it's near lunchtime. My father, coming home from his office over at the church, is perhaps going to see this. And it would be wise of me to maybe help orient his perspective on this event. So I wanted to give him a little framework to understand how this had occurred and what it was. And I chose the framework of uniformity. So I went over, Dad, you know, those windows, the five were broken and seven were good, looked really bad because, you know, they weren't even. So, and I go on with a story about how they're even now, so it has better aesthetics. And much to my surprise, my father agreed entirely with my framework of uniformity. And then he said, therefore, you can pay for all 12 panes to be replaced. I was good at framing things. I tried to negotiate, but I only broke six of them. You can pay for all 12. My negotiating skills weren't so well. It's funny how the framework or the perspectives through which we see things can influence to a great degree how well we engage something. And I'd like to share this sermon here about that particular thing, the idea of a framework for looking at missions engagement. And the first part of that would be perhaps this idea of the why. Well, the why of missions engagement. We think of this passage that we just looked at here in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, and the Apostle Paul is talking about his motivation. He's explaining to the Corinthian church his motivation for being engaged in mission. And as we read Acts, we see the different aspects of the Apostle Paul's motivation for missions. We see his ambition to be the one to share the gospel where no one has preached before. We see in other parts of it the plans that he had. It says Paul determined to. In a certain passage in the books there, we see also Paul's determination, his desire to make it all the way to Spain. We see at times his vision. It says that he had a vision of a man in Macedonia calling him to come over here and share the gospel. We see all of those different aspects that motivated the Apostle Paul. But here in this passage, I think we're looking at the core of the motivation that the Apostle Paul had for being involved in mission. And he gives it here in this verse. Compelled. I'm compelled by the love of Christ. You remember the story of the Apostle Paul, previously Saul, a Pharisee, trained in the Pharisaical tradition, one who persecuted the church. He was there when they stoned Stephen, holding the clothes, agreeing with all that was going on. And from there, he took up the baton to persecute the church. He went around trying to eliminate the sect of believers, of those that followed the way of the Christians. And one day he went and he got the letters from the high priests. And he was on the road to Damascus to go to ferret out the Christians in Damascus and haul him off to prison. And on the road to Damascus, God intervenes. Here's this man that can't understand, even though Stephen preached a gospel that would have struck right at the heart of a Pharisee and what held the Pharisees back from knowing Christ, these ones who fancy themselves the believers and Moses the prophet. And you look at Stephen's sermon and you see how he attacks the core of that. That went right over Saul's head. But here it is, God intervenes. God meets him on the road. God blinds him. God empties him of everything that's restraining him from understanding who Jesus is, who God is, what God's will is. And over the following days, we see that God restores his sight. We see that God redeems him. He restores his heart. He takes the Apostle Paul and he forgives this persecutor of his church. He changes the Apostle Paul dramatically. He shows the Apostle Paul his love. After we left that church in Goffstown, Grasmere, it was called, my father worked at Barrington College. We lived across the bay and for several years there. And from there, they went to work at Gordon College up in Massachusetts. We lived in a little town called Georgetown. I was 16, 17 years old by that time. My father was a great man. He was a faithful man, a great pastor, a great Christian, a great person. But my father was raised in the Depression. His father died from injuries in World War I in the midst of the Great Depression, leaving my grandmother, the Scot, with five little orphan boys to raise. And she was very stoic. She was the stereotypical Scot. She was Scottish. She spoke as a Scot until the day she died, even though she lived in this country for 70 years. And my father was a product of that. He was a man who was not very emotional. You wouldn't find him down in the dumps, and you certainly wouldn't find him dancing in the hallway. His emotions were flatlined. Never saw him very much with me, but he was a very determined person. And unfortunately, as a 16, 17-year-old, I was a very determined young person. And there came a day when the two immovable objects met, and I'd had it. I left home. Then I wasn't going back. I left. Didn't have a car, didn't have much money, made my way uptown, and didn't know where I was going to go. It was on to about 11 o'clock, and I was sitting on a stone wall uptown trying to figure out what my next move was. Next thing I know, I see my father's car driving by, and he sees me, and he stops, and he comes over. And I'm steeling myself for more. And he comes over, and he's coming next to me. And my father, who I'd never seen shed a tear in his life, all of a sudden he starts to weep. Weep. And he's trying to talk, and he's so emotional. He's so hung up by his emotions, he can't even get out what he wants to say. And he's trying to say, please come home. That's all he said. There were many reasons for me to go home that night. It was cold, and I didn't have a coat on. I didn't have any money. I wasn't going anywhere. But I tell you, none of that would have taken me home. When he was weeping, his love for me was so evident. It was just written all over the equation. I tell you, I couldn't not get in that car and go home. I simply went and got in the car and went home. And it was over and done with. I don't even remember what it was about. But I'll never forget what my father's love did. There's lots of reasons for missions. There's lots of whys to be engaged in God's mission. There's the mandate that we're all familiar with, that great commission, go and tell. There's the call that he puts on people's lives as he moves them individually for certain things. There's the need that we observe. We observe it continually because of the media. It keeps us in the fore. This compassion when we see poverty and poor children and women in need. There are many motivating factors for engagement in missions. But at the core, it's when the love of Christ so gets a hold of us, so consumes us. And how can it not when Jesus died for me? It's when the love of Christ so consumes us that we're just moved by that to be involved in God's mission of planting his church amongst the nations. You know, every believer in this room has a Damascus Road experience of one kind or another. That moment when God intervened in your life, when God showed you his love, when God showed you the dead-end path that your life was journeying down, and he redeemed you and restored you and showed you his love. That Damascus Road experience led the Apostle Paul to state this. There's all these reasons, and it's the love of Christ that compels me, is what he was saying. It so had a grip on the Apostle Paul because of the Damascus Road and the fact that God, even though he was the worst persecutor of the church, God loved him and he changed him. It compelled the Apostle Paul to be involved in mission. And as we see in the passage here, reading it down, the love of Christ compels us. We are therefore ambassadors of Christ. That's the framework for the why, if you will, the framework that I wanted to share for the why of missions engagement. Now I'd like to share a little bit of the framework of the how. Or expecting what? This is not meant to be a theological treatise on the motivation, nor on the how of missions. It cannot be exhaustive. There's not the time. People write books on this. But I'd like to share just a framework for the how of mission, and specifically expecting what? Lucinda and I have had, as well as all of our work in Bolivia that we'll share here in the Sunday School Hour, we've been involved in leadership and pioneers. So a part of that has been a lot of travels around the globe. Used to work with people in Russia and Europe and the Americas at one point from Bolivia. One of those trips, we were going off for leadership meetings. I believe it was in Malaysia. And we had the opportunity to visit our oldest. He was a worker in Jordan for a while, and after he got married, he and his wife were workers in Syria until things got really sloppy, and then they worked with Syrian refugees, a million of them, in the country of Lebanon. In those years, our oldest grandchild was born, a girl, Adela. She was born in Lebanon. And we had the opportunity to stop down in, forget which city it was in the Middle East, and grab a connecting flight back to Lebanon and visit them. So we packed the bags. Grandma packed the bags. I was allowed to put in one pair of spare socks. The rest was gifts for the grandkids. And amongst those gifts was, there was lots of things there, but one of the things that turned out to be a favorite was she knew that our granddaughter would like to play with Play-Doh. She's less, what, 2 years old maybe at the time? So she had the Play-Doh in. Our granddaughter, our son and daughter-in-law, wanted her to call us by Spanish names for grandma and grandpa. So you can do abuela, which is grandma, or granny, or Nona. So her name is Nona. And they wanted Adela to call me abuelo. She's not a Spanish speaker. She's not 2 years old. She can't even speak English yet. So she gets out with Beal. So I'm Beal to today. And that's not because I just had one pair of socks along. But anyways, Nona was the hit. Nona had the Play-Doh. And oh man, did she just love this Play-Doh, playing with Play-Doh. Her parents kept it on the top of the refrigerator so she wouldn't get to it when there was an adult around. And in the morning, Adela would get up and she'd go find Nona and she'd grab her by the finger and she'd haul her into the kitchen and she'd stand her right by the refrigerator. And then Adela, this high, the refrigerator this high, she'd put her hands up and she couldn't say Play-Doh. She'd, Nona, Nona, Nona. It was clear what she expected, isn't it? She expected Nona to get the Play-Doh down and play with her. And Nona was only too anxious to comply. She had a great expectation. As we engage in God's mission of sharing the good news of Jesus with other people, with the nations, what is it that we expect of God? When we think of in chapter 7 of Luke, there was a funeral procession heading out of the town of Nain when Christ went there. There's a widow whose only son has died. This woman's life is destroyed. Her future's gone. In that time, in that culture, in that place, a widow with only one son, the son dies, it's gone. Jesus walks up, and we know the story that Jesus get up and walk. And he heals him and gives him back to his mom. And the crowds there, they observe. What do they observe? They stand in awe of the power of God. But Jesus didn't heal that man because he wanted to demonstrate his power. It says there in the passage that when Jesus saw that woman, his heart went out to her. They observed power, but did they see mercy? Back some years ago, we were in the province of Chuquisaca in Bolivia, a province of about 500,000 people in the Andes Mountains. So you can imagine what it looked like with people spread out all over Kingdom Come. The towns, even the towns weren't big. Some of the towns in town is a stretch for some of these places with hundreds of people had nothing. There were just a handful of Christians here and there. One of the towns where we desired to put new workers, a new missionary, was the town of Maragua. It was about 4 hours on a dirt road in a four-wheel drive vehicle, and then 2 hours off the dirt road on a bit of a trail, wide enough for a vehicle, up to this town. We went there with a new worker, a new missionary who was with us, one of our other colleagues. I think I took my two sons along. Donnie and James were both along. They were small at the time. And we were told there's one Christian in that area of the countryside. His name is Lorenzo Campos. You can go see if you can find him. So we drove into this town of Maragua, a little dusty trail going through adobe buildings on one side, a few adobe buildings one story high, and maybe a couple of alleyways. We drove into town and we started asking, could you tell us where Lorenzo Campos lives? I was like, no way is anybody going to talk with us. It's just ripe with suspicion. They don't know us and they don't care to know us. And they're not going to tell us where Lorenzo Campos lives. We figured, well, it's not good. We're not going to spend the night here. It's starting to get on dusk. So we drove through town to a little ravine where there's a trickle of water. We put the tents up, sleeping bags out, got out the camp stove, made a little supper. We just finished supper when a young man comes walking along that trail, that road. And surprisingly, he comes over to us. Hey, where are you guys from? Who are you? So we told him where we're from. It said, and we're here. We were sent to look for Lorenzo Campos. And he says, I'm Lorenzo Campos. And the next phrase, he says, you got to come with me. My grandfather's been struck by lightning. You got to come with me. So we pack up things, and three of us, the new missionary from the mountains of Wyoming, one other worker, Tim was his name, and myself, would take off across this little rickety wooden bridge. The slats across the bridge, 3 out of 4 were broken, so we're picking away. And then we hit the other side, and it's up. And we're already at about probably 11,000 feet, and it's up. And Lorenzo Campos is getting on to be dusk, and he's booking it for home. Up. He's like mountain goat. So we're trying, we're sucking oxygen, doing our best to keep up with him. The new missionary from the mountains of Wyoming, I tell you, he lost his lunch, but actually we had just eaten supper. So he had to turn around and head back down. And the two of us are doing all we can to keep Lorenzo in sight because he's not waiting. An hour and something later, we arrive at the little family compound, which is a stone and mud wall about yay high, a little entranceway. And off to the right, there was a couple of rooms, adobe rooms with thatch huts. Off to the left, there was another adobe building, probably 10 feet by 15 feet with a thatched roof. And we go in there, that's where his grandfather is, a little makeshift bed, a raised portion of the floor. And he's in there, and they bring us a lawa, a porridge made out of wheat. And then we ask, well, when's the last time he ate? It's been 2 weeks. He's not going to make it to the morning. We prayed for him. I believe God heals. And we had to make it back to the Jeeps. We had one flashlight between the two of us, and the batteries were getting. It was dusk. It was dark. 10 minutes after we left, it was dark. It was an adventure. We nearly went off a cliff on the way down. Another story. We made it back down to the vehicles, the tents. We slept the night. And the following day, we went back into town. We lived on a Quechua Bible Institute property, Bible school property, which was a center for people, Quechua believers that would come in, the few that lived in that area of the countryside. About a month later, news comes in, somebody comes into the room there and says, Lorenzo is coming to town. So I go out to meet him and I start to express my condolences for his grandfather. And he goes, he said, no. The following day he was getting better. He's back working in the gardens. You want to know what I expected? I expected him to die. We prayed for him, and I believe, because I've seen enough of it, that God heals people. God's healed a lot of people in the Quechua world. But my expectation was that he was going to die. I found time after time that my expectations in relation to what God will do are pint size. Why would he not want to heal him? Why would he not show his mercy? He's demonstrated himself time and time again to be the God of mercy. John chapter 7. Jesus has been out on the Mount of Olives spending the night. He comes back into the temple courts. He's teaching once again to the crowd in the temple courts. And in come the Pharisees, and they drag in this woman who's been caught in adultery. She's condemned. She's destroyed, this woman. She's humiliated. They put her in front of the crowd, in front of Jesus. Her head is hung. She has no hope. The law requires justice. Her sin demands punishment. And what does Jesus do? Jesus crouches over, and he starts to doodle in the sand. Can you picture it? Doesn't say anything. The Pharisees, he's so given to condemn, so given to implement the law. They insist. So Jesus, if you're so intent on stoning her, let the first person who has no sin throw the rock. We know the story. After a little while, Jesus crouches back over and keeps on doodling in the sand. After a little while, he looks up and he says to the woman, they're all gone. No one there to condemn you? And then what does he do? He shows her mercy. Jesus is the God of unfailing mercy. As we engage mission, oftentimes I think we get a little skeptical as to what God's going to do. What is it? He's the God who loves to show mercy. As we share the good news of Jesus, what is it that we expect? As we engage in mission, what is it that we expect? What should be our framework for engaging in mission as to what we expect from God as we share the good news, as we're involved in living out His way, His kingdom life, a life of servanthood, a life of making Jesus known? What is it that we should expect? What should be the framework? For the Apostle Paul, it was evident from what he engaged in and the way he tackled it, he expected God to act. Not everybody responds to the mercy of God. But the Apostle Paul never wanted to leave anyone with the without the opportunity to respond to God's mercy. As we engage mission, like the Apostle Paul, may we not fail to give opportunity for people to respond to the mercy of God. May we do that, unlike me in that instance where I was expecting that person to die, and people die, and I've seen enough people die. But why not expect God to show His mercy? That's who He is. He's the God of unfailing mercy. That's it. That's the framework.